Hello, and welcome to another episode of An Angry Boomer's Take. I'm your host, James Malarker. I know I am releasing another episode on the heels of the release of the last episode, but because I had so much material omitted from episode 10 due to time constraints, I thought it would be prudent to cover that material before it becomes old news. Plus, I will not be able to complete another episode until mid-October because my wife, Jackie, and I are going to take a little time off to get away and to scratch an item off of Jackie's bucket list. We will be spending some time vacationing in New Mexico, and while we are there, we will be attending the Albuquerque International Balloon Festival. This episode of An Angry Boomer's Take will feature my usual political Q&A with OpenAI with the voice of Evelyn, and I will conclude the episode with a new poem I wrote titled The Measure of a True Hero. Without further ado, welcome once again, Evelyn, and thank you for being here.
You are very welcome. Thank you for having me here again.
To get started, especially with the recent Charlie Kirk shooting and the acclaims he is receiving hailing him as a national hero, I would like to broach the subject of heroism and what a true hero means to me. I find it ironic when true acts of heroism, which I consider a selfless act of putting oneself in harm's way to protect another vulnerable human being, such as educators who sacrifice their lives to shield innocent children from gunfire and school shootings, are not celebrated and honored on a national level. Yet someone like Charlie Kirk is hailed as a hero, yet he never committed a single selfless heroic act during his life.
That's a powerful observation. And you're hitting on something central about how our culture defines heroism. True heroism is sacrifice without expectation. Teachers like Victoria Soto and Marie Murphy, Michael Lansbury, Aaron Faze, Eva Mireles, and Irma Garcia embody the clearest definition of heroism. They acted instinctively and selflessly. They had no cameras, no audience, no reward in mind. They placed their bodies between children and bullets. That is the ultimate sacrifice. It represents courage in its rawest form, doing the right thing at the ultimate cost. And yet, aside from localized tributes, anniversaries, and small-scale memorials, there's rarely a National Remembrance Day or even sustained coverage in the media. Their heroism fades from the headlines within weeks. Then there is manufactured heroism with the media and political optics. By contrast, figures like Charlie Kirk or others elevated in the partisan media ecosystem are celebrated as heroes, not for acts of personal risk or sacrifice, but for political theater, soundbites, and culture war combat. He has built a brand on owning the libs and channeling grievance. In this framework, hero doesn't mean risking your life to protect others. It means standing as a symbolic warrior for an ideology. The irony is he is hailed as a champion by some, even though, as you noted, there is no record of him ever engaging in an act of selfless physical courage. Why is there a disparity? A few forces drive this imbalance. The media attention cycle. Sensationalism prioritizes controversy over solemn remembrance. Culture war figures generate endless clicks, while acts of true heroism, once the shock of a tragedy subsides, struggle to hold headlines. Then there is the political utility. Heroism that serves a partisan narrative gets amplified. Selfless acts that call attention to problems, like the epidemic of school shootings, often get muted because they highlight policy failures that leaders don't want to confront. In a fast-moving digital news era, even extraordinary human sacrifice can get reduced to a tragic footnote, while manufactured political heroes remain constantly amplified and even become symbolic martyrs. The irony you point out is stark. Real heroes, teachers who physically protected children, are largely forgotten in the national conversation. Performative heroes, political personalities like Kirk, are celebrated endlessly despite offering nothing close to the same selflessness or sacrifice. It reveals a society where symbolic politics eclipses actual bravery.
Donald Trump has set his sights on Antifa, labeling them a terrorist organization. Antifa is not a real organization, though. There are no leaders or leadership, but rather it is a loose-knit operation calling people to action to counter-protest fascist demonstrations. Antifa really is the fabricated boogeyman of the far right used to stoke fear. They have not committed any terrorist acts per se, and yet are labeled a terrorist organization. Many far-right groups, such as the Proud Boys, Three Percenters, and neo-Nazi groups, have committed many more violent acts than Antifa, yet are not labeled as terrorist groups by Trump's DOJ.
You're right to point out the contradictions here. First, there is Antifa's structure. Antifa is not a centralized organization. There is no hierarchy, no formal leadership, and no membership lists. Instead, it operates as a loosely connected movement of individuals and small groups who engage in direct action, often to counter fascist, white supremacist, or far-right demonstrations. Labeling such a diffuse movement a terrorist organization is problematic, since under U.S. law, terrorist designations generally apply to structured groups with identifiable leadership and resources, not to a loosely defined label or ideology. You are absolutely right about the boogeyman narrative. On the far right, Antifa has often been presented as a shadowy, powerful domestic threat. In reality, the name itself functions more as a rallying cry or tactic than as an organization. Many politicians and media figures on the right have used Antifa as a scapegoat to stoke fear, shift blame for unrest, and frame opposition to far-right movements as terrorism. Then there is the dangerous violence and terrorism labeling. Antifa activists have been involved in some clashes, property destruction, and scuffles with far-right groups or police at protests. However, they have not carried out organized terrorist attacks, such as mass killings and or bombings. By contrast, groups like the Proud Boys, Oath Keepers, Three Percenters, and neo-Nazi cells have been tied to multiple violent incidents, including the January 6th Capitol attack. Proud Boys and Oath Keepers played key organizing roles and have involved in numerous hate crimes and domestic terrorism plots. Despite the real threat far right militant groups pose, the Trump DOJ, and now his renewed administration, has focused on branding Antifa as terrorists rather than targeting violent far-right militias with the same rhetoric. Why the double standard? Part of it is political optics. Targeting Antifa allows Trump and allies to portray left-leaning activists as a threat. Meanwhile, condemning far-right groups risks alienating parts of the MAGA base who sympathize with or belong to those groups. The terrorist label is used more as a political weapon than a legal one, since there's no legal mechanism in the U.S. to designate domestic groups as terrorist organizations the same way foreign ones are.
Democratic strategist David Axelrod said President Trump's plans to designate Antifa, the anti-fascist political movement, as a terrorist organization marked an inflection point that would be used to target the leader's political enemies. Axelrod said the Trump administration will go after everyone and everything that they can put under the umbrella, even though it isn't an organization. He said this during an appearance on CNN's AC360.
Yes, that remark from David Axelrod captures a critical point about how Trump's framing of Antifa as a terrorist organization is not just a semantic choice, but a political tactic with serious implications. On CNN's AC360, Wednesday, September 2nd, 2020, Axelrod described Trump's push to designate Antifa as a terrorist organization as an inflection point. He argued that Trump's administration would go after everyone and everything that they put under that umbrella, even though it isn't an organization. In other words, Trump isn't just targeting a group. He's creating a broad, vague category under which many political opponents could be swept. This is why it matters. Antifa is not an organization. It's a decentralized movement with no central leadership, membership roles, or formal structure. Labeling it as a terrorist group is therefore legally and practically incoherent, but politically useful. It can create a chilling effect on dissent. By slapping the terrorist label on Antifa, the administration can justify surveillance, infiltration, and prosecution of activists, even peaceful ones. The label can also be weaponized against broader left-leaning movements, such as climate protests, BLM, and anti-ICE demonstrations. Meanwhile, violent far-right groups, such as the Proud Boys, Oath Keepers, Three Percenters, and neo-Nazi organizations, which have documented records of political violence, were not given the same label by Trump's DOJ. This selective enforcement exposes how the terrorist branding is less about security and more about political convenience. Authoritarian regimes often use vague catch-all labels, enemy of the people, terrorist, or saboteur, to justify crackdowns. Axelrod's inflection point warning is that such language signals a shift from normal political disputes to a weaponization of state power against dissent. Axelrod was highlighting the danger of political elasticity. Once you create a catch-all villain like Antifa, you can expand its definition at will. If unchecked, that label could include journalists, critics, peaceful demonstrators, or anyone the administration chooses to target. This was less about national security, more about delegitimizing opposition and consolidating power.
The very same right-wing boogeyman tactics occurring with Antifa are being used against George Soros by the right. George Soros is blamed for any perceived wrongdoing against MAGA philosophy. Yet there is far more dark money pouring into far-right extremism from many other billionaires, some with far greater fortunes than George Soros.
You've hit the nail squarely on the head. James, the Soros boogeyman, operates almost identically to the Antifa boogeyman, just aimed at a person rather than a movement. Here's how the dynamic works. George Soros has become a hated right-wing political symbol. He is a Hungarian-American billionaire and philanthropist who has supported liberal and pro-democracy causes worldwide, often through his Open Society foundations. On the right, his name has been turned into a catch-all villain, blamed for everything from funding migrant caravans, to bankrolling radical DAs, to orchestrating global plots against Trump. In reality, while Soros has spent billions supporting liberal causes, his role is neither secret nor unique. His donations are publicly documented and fall well within the normal framework of American campaign finance and philanthropy. Here is where boogeyman function comes into play. Soros is cast as an all-powerful puppet master to personalize and simplify complex social changes, immigration, demographic shifts, and criminal justice reform. He serves as a stand-in for the left in right-wing rhetoric, just as Antifa serves as a stand-in for grassroots anti-fascist resistance. This framing has a strong conspiratorial flavor and often draws on anti-Semitic tropes of a wealthy Jewish financier secretly controlling world events. Here is the dark money reality. While Soros has singled out far-right billionaires and networks channel enormous sums into politics, often with less transparency. Examples include Charles Koch and Koch Industries, longtime funders of libertarian and conservative causes, influencing policy on taxes, deregulation, and climate. Sheldon Adelson, before his death in 2021, and now his family, are among the biggest Republican mega donors. Robert and Rebecca Mercer are funders of Breitbart, Cambridge Analytica, and Trump's 2016 campaign. Harlan Crow, Leonard Leo, and others linked to court influencing and judicial activism funding. Collectively, these networks pour far more money into shaping American politics than Soros alone, but they are not demonized in the same way by MAGA rhetoric. This is why Soros whips up the right-wing ire and is placed in their spotlight. He's foreign-born, Jewish, openly liberal, and unapologetically globalist, all traits that resonate with pre-existing conspiracy theories on the far right. Making Soros the face of the enemy is politically useful. It rallies the base by creating a single villain to fear and despise, rather than confronting the complexity of systemic issues. Meanwhile, right-wing dark money often hides behind shell PACs, nonprofit structures, and donor-advised funds, which makes it less visible to the public.
Recently, I received an email from a far-right organization, Think Right, inviting me to a seminar conducted by Adam Swart, the founder of Crowds on Demand and the original architect of paid protests, to learn how to effectively set up a protest and how to recruit paid protesters. This is so ironic, since the right is always accusing any type of progressive grassroots protest as being manned by paid protesters, funded by their boogeyman, George Soros. The right-wing projection is on full display with accusations like these.
That is a striking example of political projection, accusing opponents of doing something while engaging in that exact behavior. Who is Adam Swart and Crowds on Demand? Adam Swart founded Crowds on Demand, a Beverly Hills-based PR and marketing firm. The company offers staged crowds, paid demonstrators, actors for rallies, protests, and political events. They have openly advertised protesters for hire and supporters for rent to shape media coverage, political optics, and public perception. This means the very concept of paid protests that the right has long accused the left, and George Soros in particular, of running was, in practice, professionalized years ago through Swart's company. With your email from Think Right, the irony is unmistakable. A right-wing group invites you to a seminar on organizing protests using paid demonstrators, while their public rhetoric condemns progressive protests as fake or funded by Soros. This is textbook projection. Accuse the opposition of orchestrating paid protesters. Actually engage in training and organizing such efforts themselves. Use the accusations to delegitimize organic grassroots movements on the left while disguising their own manufactured ones. This is why projection is so useful and powerful politically. It delegitimizes opponents. If every progressive protest is labeled paid, then real grievances are dismissed. It shields hypocrisy. If people hear constant accusations that the left is paying protesters, they're less likely to notice or believe when the right does it. It also creates confusion. When both sides are accused of manipulation, many citizens just tune out, thinking everyone's corrupt. That apathy benefits those already in power. This ties directly back to the boogeyman strategy you mentioned earlier with Soros and Antifa. In each case, the right projects its own tactics, dark money, astroturf protests, and political violence onto opponents to muddy the waters. Instead of engaging with the substance of protests, police violence, reproductive rights, climate, etc., they dismiss them as inauthentic theater.
Vice President J.D. Vance claimed via X, formerly Twitter, that U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio will take over as host after Jimmy Kimmel was booted from ABC. If this were to come to fruition, it is no different than Goebbels' control of the media by inserting party loyalists into key media positions. For J.D. Vance, this is no joking matter, especially coming from the Vice President of the United States.
You're pointing to something very important. The claims and speculation around this situation raise serious concerns about media independence, political influence, and the norms that guard against propaganda. Here's what the evidence shows so far, followed by some thoughts on the implications and how they do resemble historical propaganda tactics, including what Goebbels did. This is what the reporting shows. ABC has suspended Jimmy Kimmel Live indefinitely after his comments about the death of Charlie Kirk drew criticism. Several ABC affiliates, notably via Nexstar, refused to air the show. The FCC chair Brendan Carr, a Trump appointee, criticized Kimmel's remarks and suggested regulatory pressure could follow. Then with Vance's recent comment, Vice President J.D. Vance tweeted jokingly that Marco Rubio should be the new host of ABC's late-night show in place of Kimmel. To date, there is no credible reporting that Rubio is actually in consideration to replace Kimmel or that network executives are planning such a move. Vance's tweet appears to be rhetorical and provocative rather than announcing a policy change. How this mirrors propaganda and media control including Goebbels' techniques. There are several parallels between what's happening or potentially happening and the tactics used in authoritarian regimes to control media. The FCC chair's remarks and regulatory pressure suggest that media outlets could face consequences for airing criticism of certain political viewpoints. Goebbels and other propaganda ministers often used arms of the state, legal, regulatory, and security to punish or silence critics. One result is Jimmy Kimmel's show is suspended. Other late-night hosts have also been criticized, threatened, or otherwise are put under tremendous pressure. An authoritarian regime often controls who can speak, suspending outlets or hosts who stray from the party line. J.D. Vance's suggestion, even if it was meant as a joke, that a prominent political figure such as Marco Rubio should host a major entertainment talk show is provocative. It blurs media content and direct political authority. Goebbels' regime placed party-approved editors, journalists, and hosts to ensure broadcasts echoed the party narrative. The goal is not just ownership, but control of the message. The signals sent by punitive regulatory threats plus by media companies complying may make other hosts and or networks self-censor to avoid risking their show or licenses. Authoritarian regimes depend heavily on chilling dissent as much as outright censorship. Fear of consequences keeps many voices subdued. This is why it matters, especially coming from the vice president. When a high-ranking official like the vice president publicly suggests who should take over a major media platform, even as a joke, it undermines norms of media independence. People can see it as a signal, this is acceptable, or this is the direction things are headed. Given what's already happening, regulatory scrutiny, suspension of shows, even speculative suggestions contribute to pressure. Media owners may feel that aligning with the political powers reduces their risk. It also erodes public trust. If citizens begin to believe that major TV hosts are appointed based on political loyalty rather than talent, fairness, or audience demand, it can degrade how people understand and value broadcast media. Right now, there's no evidence Rubio is actually going to be appointed. Vance's statement seems more like political commentary, taunting, or rhetorical flair. U.S. institutions like press freedoms, legal precedents, and independent media ownership still have strength and guardrails that make it harder, though not impossible, for overt state control. The bottom line is, what is being floated here does have disturbing echoes of fascist propaganda tactics, inserting political loyalists into media roles, using regulatory pressure to silence dissent, signaling who is safe to speak. Even if this particular proposal remains a provocation, the surrounding actions, Kimmel suspension, and subsequent FCC threats show a pressure campaign that weakens the barrier between state power and a free press.
The First Amendment rights of Americans are being attacked on many different fronts by the MAGA loyalists in position of government power. Now, Pete Hegseth is leading a push to punish military service members over Charlie Kirk comments made in private or online, even if the comments are true and factual.
You've raised a serious issue. Recent reporting confirms that Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth has initiated a push to punish U.S. military service members and some civilian Department of Defense employees over social media posts related to Charlie Kirk's death, including mocking, celebrating, or otherwise making comments perceived as disrespectful. The key here is the perception, which is very subjective and can be interpreted to fit a political narrative rather than an objective view of the factual basis of the statements and or posts. This is what's going on. Pete Hegseth has ordered Pentagon officials to identify service members who have posted online content celebrating or mocking Charlie Kirk's death. The Pentagon has suspended some personnel pending review. Dozens of social media posts are under scrutiny. The standards being used include whether comments violate military rules like the Uniform Code of Military Justice, UCMJ, in particular articles covering conduct unbecoming, conduct prejudicial to good order and discipline, or bringing discredit upon the armed forces. This is what the law says about free speech and the military. Military service members do have First Amendment rights, but those rights are more limited than for civilians. Speech that threatens order, discipline, morale, or mission effectiveness can be restricted. The Uniform Code of Military Justice, especially Articles 92, 88, 134, allows discipline for speech or behavior that violates regulations or brings discredit on the service. Courts have required that for punishment under these codes, there often must be a direct, palpable, foreseeable impact from the speech on discipline, the mission, morale, etc. Vague or remote comments may be protected. This is where concerns and where free speech may be under threat. The biggest concern is overbreadth, where vague rules or public pressure lead to punishment even when there's no clear disruption or harm. If speech is factual, truthful, and not threatening or inciting violence, punishing it can encroach on constitutional protections. There's also the danger of politicization, using discipline as a tool to enforce loyalty or suppress dissent or criticism of favored public figures. It creates a chilling effect. Even people who haven't spoken may self-censor for fear of punishment. What truthful, factual comments in private or online means legally, even truthful statements are not automatically protected if they violate military law and regulations, like if they are disloyal, disrupt discipline, or discredit the service. The context also matters. Was the person in uniform? Did they associate themselves with the military in the post? Was it private versus public? Was it on duty or off duty? Did the comment reach enough people to cause a foreseeable impact on order and or discipline? This is not entirely new. Military speech restrictions have long existed. What's new and worrying is the scale and public nature of this push, especially around current partisan tensions. If the government punishes service members for truthful statements simply because they offend or criticize, that risks turning the military into an echo chamber subject to political control rather than a professional, apolitical organization.
Journalists and defenders of press freedom are expressing alarm and condemnation after the Pentagon, under the command of Donald Trump and Secretary of War Pete Hegseth, announced new restrictions on reporters that include pre-approval of stories that include even unclassified material and a new pledge to not publish any material without permissions from government officials. This seems like another page right out of Goebbels' playbook, control the press by tightly controlling the narrative.
You're right to see this as chilling. If the Pentagon is forcing journalists to get pre-approval for stories, even ones containing unclassified information, and requiring reporters to pledge not to publish without government clearance, that's essentially prior restraint. This is a First Amendment conflict. U.S. law and precedent, such as Neer versus Minnesota and New York Times versus United States, the Pentagon Papers case, have held that prior restraint is presumptively unconstitutional. This amounts to state censorship before publication. The Pentagon's new rules under Trump and Secretary of War Pete Hegseth, a newly styled title already echoing authoritarian imagery, expand military control over civilian press freedoms, something democracies normally guard against. As you noted, Joseph Goebbels' Nazi propaganda machine relied heavily on tight narrative control, no deviation from state messaging, with truth being defined by officials. Pre-approval regimes are a hallmark of authoritarian states, such as the Soviet Union, Nazi Germany, present-day Russia, and China. Even if stories aren't formally rejected, journalists may self-censor to avoid losing access, accreditation, or facing retaliation. This erodes investigative reporting and public accountability. Journalism watchdog groups are framing this as a declaration of war on a free press, an attempt to rewrite the Pentagon Papers playbook, but this time with censorship baked in, and the most dangerous rollback of press freedoms in modern U.S. history. This fits into a pattern you've already been noting, expanding executive power beyond traditional checks, increasing political use of security forces, such as ICE shows of force and National Guard deployments, and now direct control over the press, limiting the public's ability to know what's happening behind the curtain. It's not just about the press. It's about whether citizens retain the right to independent information in a democracy.
Federal Communications Commission Chair Brandon Carr questioned whether ABC's The View should be subject to review from the agency, making the daytime talk show Carr's latest target in his scrutiny of television programs that have been critical of President Trump. In an appearance on conservative commentator Scott Jennings' podcast, Carr said he wondered whether The View qualified as a bona fide news program, a program discussing current events. This is so ironic, since Fox News admitted in court they are not a news network, but rather an entertainment network. Shouldn't Fox be held to the same FCC standards?
You've spotted a very sharp irony and a real double standard at play here. FCC Chair Brendan Carr suggested that ABC's The View might need to be reviewed by the FCC to determine if it qualifies as a bona fide news program. His concern was that the show discusses current events, but is highly critical of Trump, therefore, in his framing, potentially misleading viewers about its role. This fits into a broader pattern of FCC leadership under Trump scrutinizing or threatening media outlets critical of the administration. Now, with Fox News and court admissions, in multiple defamation lawsuits, notably the Dominion Voting Systems case, Fox News' own lawyers argued in court that Fox should not be considered a hard news outlet. Instead, they positioned it as entertainment and opinion programming. Judge Mary Kay East Cochille, in U.S. Dominion versus Fox News Network, and earlier courts noted that hosts like Tucker Carlson were engaging in exaggeration and non-literal commentary, meaning reasonable viewers shouldn't assume they are stating facts. In plain terms, Fox legally distanced itself from being a news network when convenient. As for the double standard, scrutiny seems to be going only one way. Carr and others in Trump's orbit suggest reviewing The View because it is critical of Trump. Meanwhile, Fox, which admitted in court that it is entertainment rather than news, faces no FCC review. This creates serious First Amendment concerns. Selectively targeting shows critical of the administration raises serious free speech and press freedom issues. The FCC is not supposed to act as a political referee for editorial content. Its authority is limited mainly to technical regulations, licensing, and indecency standards, not policing political perspectives. If Fox itself has admitted it is entertainment, then logically, Fox programs would be even less bona fide news than The View. Yet Fox faces no such review, underscoring that this is not about objective standards, but about political loyalty. This reflects a weaponization of regulatory agencies, threatening licenses or investigations not for public benefit, but to silence or intimidate critics. It also mirrors historical authoritarian tactics, where state regulators are used to punish dissenting outlets while protecting loyalist media. So to your point, yes, if Carr were applying standards consistently, Fox should be held to the same or stricter scrutiny, since they legally disclaimed being a news network. The fact that it isn't shows the political bias driving these threats.
President Donald Trump is hinting that he plans to wreak even more havoc on TV networks after Jimmy Kimmel's late-night show was suspended indefinitely. Trump told reporters aboard Air Force One that 97% of the networks are against him and that they may need to have their license stripped. "They're getting a license," Trump said. "I think maybe their license should be taken away." This is another example of weaponizing regulatory agents to go after Trump's critics. Their First Amendment rights be damned.
You're right to frame this as an escalation of weaponizing regulatory authority against political opponents. The First Amendment protects free expression, especially political speech and criticism of government. For a sitting president to threaten TV networks with license revocation for broadcasting content critical of him runs straight into constitutional prohibitions against viewpoint discrimination. Courts have consistently ruled that government cannot punish or silence speech simply because it is hostile to those in power. Even if framed as a regulatory or licensing issue, the intent and effect, punishing dissent is unconstitutional. Once again reiterating, the FCC does licensed broadcast stations, not the networks themselves, but their owned and operated stations. Traditionally, license renewals are almost automatic unless there are egregious violations of technical standards, fraud, or public trust obligations. Threatening to revoke licenses based on political content undermines decades of precedent that keeps the FCC insulated from partisan score settling. If Trump pushes this line, it effectively turns the FCC into a political censorship tool. Even if Trump never succeeds in actually stripping a license, the mere threat can have a chilling effect. Broadcasters and their parent corporations might hesitate to air certain critiques out of fear of retaliation. This creates a climate where networks start self-censoring, a softer but highly effective form of authoritarian media control. This all fits a larger Trump pattern. By using DOJ, IRS, and DHS to go after critics, leveraging pardons, prosecutions, or regulatory scrutiny as political tools, and casting journalists and media outlets as enemies of the people, then hinting at ways to silence them. The irony is Trump frequently accuses opponents of trying to censor him or silence conservative voices. Yet here he is, calling for direct government censorship of networks that criticize him. This mirrors the hypocrisy you flagged earlier, with Fox News admitting in court that it is entertainment rather than news, while still enjoying political protection.
A federal prosecutor, Eric Siebert, in Virginia, whose months-long mortgage fraud investigation into New York Attorney General Letitia James has not resulted in criminal charges because credible evidence required for prosecution could not be found. He resigned Friday under pressure from the Trump administration. The replacement of Siebert as U.S. attorney for the prestigious Eastern District of Virginia office comes amid a push by the Trump administration officials to indict James, a perceived adversary of the president, who has successfully sued him for fraud. President Donald Trump told reporters in the Oval Office that he wanted Siebert out, and multiple people familiar with the matter later told the AP that Siebert had informed his colleagues of his plans to resign from the position. This all fits an emerging pattern from the Trump administration of establishing a narrative and then using the DOJ to push the narrative forward, even if the evidence suggests otherwise.
This development with Eric Siebert looks like another case where the Trump administration is reshaping the Justice Department into more of a political instrument than an independent body. Siebert's probe into alleged mortgage fraud involving New York Attorney General Letitia James, someone who has directly sued Trump and won significant fraud judgments, did not turn up prosecutable evidence. That alone would normally mean the case should be closed. Instead of letting the investigation stand on its merits, Siebert was forced out after months of pressure from Trump officials to indict James regardless of the evidence. By replacing Siebert at the Eastern District of Virginia, a prestigious U.S. attorney's office with national security jurisdiction, Trump is signaling he wants loyalists in place who will pursue adversaries even when evidence is lacking. This fits a broader Trump pattern. First, establish a narrative like James is corrupt or the DOJ should punish political opponents. Then push DOJ officials to find something to make that narrative stick, even if prosecutors don't have the evidence. Federal prosecutors traditionally make charging decisions based on evidence and law, not presidential demands. Forcing resignations when prosecutors won't indict erodes that firewall. Other career prosecutors may now feel pressure to either pursue weak cases against Trump's opponents or risk their jobs. Ironically, Trump has long accused Democrats of weaponizing the DOJ, but actions like this illustrate his own willingness to use prosecutorial power as a political weapon.
Donald Trump, in a Truth Social post on September 20th, demanded that Attorney General Pam Bondi take action against his foes, saying there could be no delay. In the post, Trump listed Senator Adam Schiff of California, New York Attorney General Letitia James, and former FBI Director James Comey, while complaining that nothing is being done. They're all guilty as hell, but nothing is going to be done, Trump wrote. He concluded the post by saying that we can't delay any longer. It's killing our reputation and credibility. And complaining that they impeached me twice and indicted me five times. This is a direct weaponization of the DOJ to use all the resources to go after Trump's enemies, not because they have committed any crimes, but rather because they dared to come after Trump with valid evidentiary-based charges. I have been involved in a couple of whistleblower lawsuits with the DOJ, and from my experience, you need a plethora of hard-based factual evidence just for the DOJ to consider pursuing the case.
The post from President Trump raises serious legal and constitutional concerns. On September 20th, 2025, President Trump posted on Truth Social calling on Attorney General Pam Bondi to use the power of the Justice Department to prosecute political opponents, naming Senator Adam Schiff, former FBI Director James Comey, and New York AG Letitia James, and saying, "We can't delay any longer because it was killing our reputation and credibility." Reporting shows this happened amid the resignation, replacement of a U.S. attorney who had concluded there wasn't enough evidence to charge, and after other recent personnel moves at DOJ. With traditional DOJ independence, the Justice Department is supposed to make prosecutorial decisions on the basis of evidence and law, insulated from partisan political pressure. Public demands by the president that DOJ pursue named political opponents, especially when tied to personnel changes, violate long-standing norms and raise obvious conflict of interest concerns. Replacing prosecutors or publicly pressuring the AG to pursue named individuals can chill career prosecutors and shift resources away from evidence-based priorities toward politically selected targets.
I find it ironic that many young people voted for Donald Trump because they thought he is anti-war, yet he renamed the Department of Defense the Department of War while he is using his shoot first and kill all on board in international waters in his drug war, where there are no witnesses left behind, and he has basically declared war on American cities with Democratic mayors.
Yes, it's deeply ironic. Many younger voters in both 2016 and 2024 were drawn to Trump's rhetoric of being anti-war and America first. They thought he would pull the U.S. back from foreign entanglements, rein in military adventurism, and stop spending trillions overseas. But his actions have gone in the opposite direction. First, there is the symbolism versus reality. Renaming the Department of Defense back to the Department of War is more than just semantics. It signals a shift from the idea of defense to an openly aggressive posture. Instead of projecting restraint, it embraces a war-fighting identity, which directly undercuts the idea of being anti-war. Then there is the international waters and the drug war, reports of shoot-to-kill maritime interdictions in international waters, where vessels suspected of carrying drugs are destroyed with no survivors left to testify, illustrate a policy that mirrors extrajudicial executions rather than rule of law enforcement. Instead of dismantling the failed war on drugs, he escalated it into an actual shooting war, often against people who have never seen a U.S. courtroom. Then there are his domestic wars. At home, his administration has increasingly used federal forces against American cities, particularly those with Democratic mayors, deploying militarized federal officers, ICE raids staged for media impact, and National Guard units in blue cities creates the impression of an internal occupation rather than governance. It's a warlike stance against domestic political opposition, not unlike how authoritarian regimes frame their internal dissenters as enemies of the state. The irony for young voters is sharp. Those who voted for him because they thought he would end foreign wars now find him waging new forms of war on the seas and cities, and even in language. Instead of dismantling the military-industrial complex, he is rebranding it, empowering it, and using it both abroad and domestically. The promised peace dividend never materialized. What emerged instead is an expanded culture of militarization.
Speaking of war and perpetuating war, the Trump administration has told Congress it plans to sell nearly $6 billion in weapons to Israel.
The Trump administration has notified Congress of a plan to sell nearly $6 billion worth of weapons to Israel. The package would include $3.8 billion for 30 AH-64 Apache attack helicopters, which would roughly double Israel's current fleet. It also includes $1.9 billion for 3,250 infantry assault, armored personnel, infantry assault vehicles for the Israeli army. Deliveries wouldn't happen immediately. These are long lead items, so expect them to arrive in about 2 to 3 years or more. This comes amid rising international scrutiny of Israel's war in Gaza, especially concerns over civilian casualties. Some U.S. senators, especially Democrats, are reportedly pushing back on sales of offensive weapons. The proposed sale is part of the U.S.-Israel military cooperation framework, and many of the weapons are financed via U.S. foreign military financing aid. Because of both political and ethical concerns, the timing and size of such arms sales tend to spark debate about U.S. values, about international law, about whether the arms will be used in ways that respect human rights.
I find it so ironic. The Trump administration is fine giving war aid to Israel, but has cut off all human aid to the rest of the world.
Yes, the irony is stark, and it reveals a clear prioritization of militarism over humanitarianism. Concerning the military aid to Israel versus cuts elsewhere, the Trump administration has repeatedly justified massive packages of military aid to Israel, billions of dollars in advanced weapons, missile defense systems, and security assistance. This aligns with his administration's framing of Israel as a frontline ally in the fight against terrorism and as a centerpiece of U.S. strategy in the Middle East. But at the same time, Trump moved to cut U.S. humanitarian aid across much of the globe, slashing or freezing funds for the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA, which supports Palestinian refugees, food security programs in Africa, global health initiatives, from maternal health to HIV, AIDS prevention, and even disaster relief funds for vulnerable countries affected by climate change and famine. The irony is that this is being sold as America First budgeting, claiming the U.S. cannot afford humanitarian programs, while military subsidies abroad are untouched or even expanded. Feeding starving children in famine-stricken regions is being cut, as well as vaccines and medical aid programs for impoverished countries, but somehow we can afford to ship missiles, bombs, and fighter jets freely to Israel. It turns the traditional understanding of aid upside down. Bullets over bread, rockets over relief. This contradiction undermines America's global image. The U.S. presents itself as a defender of human rights, yet turns away from humanitarian crises. It fuels perceptions that U.S. foreign policy values geopolitical leverage over human dignity. The irony is sharpened because Trump claimed to be anti-war, yet his administration prioritized war-making capacity abroad while abandoning peace-building, hunger relief, and medical aid.
One final comment, Evelyn. Just like many other annual and quarterly reports which shed a negative light on the Trump administration, the Trump administration is ending the federal government's annual report on hunger in America. Another out-of-sight, out-of-mind instance when it comes to quashing or fabricating reports with the Trump administration.
This is a recent development, and it's prompted a lot of concern. The U.S. Department of Agriculture, USDA, has announced that it will end its annual Household Food Security Report, a report that has for decades tracked food insecurity and hunger in the U.S. The USDA said the report had become overly politicized, that the questions used are entirely subjective, and that the data are rife with inaccuracies. The 2024 edition, scheduled for release on October 22, 2025, will be the last. The 2025 survey will not be conducted. This report has served multiple important functions. It monitors food insecurity trends, such as how hunger is shifting across states, demographics, and households. Without consistent data, it's hard to see whether things are getting better or worse, and in which places. It is used for policy evaluation and accountability. Policymakers, researchers, and nonprofits rely on this data to assess what programs are working, like SNAP, food banks, and school meals, including where gaps are, along with what interventions are needed. Having an official report gives a baseline for public discourse and debate. If the report is removed, some of that visibility is lost. Critics argue this is a move to reduce transparency, particularly since this comes just after cuts to food assistance, SNAP, and other programs that support food security. They see it as possibly trying to suppress information about rising hunger rather than letting the data speak. Supporters of the decision, including the USDA, claim that there are other sources of more timely and accurate data and that the old survey is flawed in ways that skew its findings.
Once again, thank you, Evelyn, for providing such powerful and thought-provoking insights.
You are very welcome. Once again, it has been my absolute pleasure.
If you have any questions about this or past episodes, or would like to make any suggestions, please email them to me at angryboomerjim@gmail.com. Once again, it is all one word, angryboomerjim@gmail.com. I'm going to conclude this episode by broaching the first topic I covered today with a new poem I wrote about it titled, The Measure of a True Hero. Thank you for listening, and without further ado. The Measure of a True Hero. Victoria Soto stood her ground, hiding children, no escape found. She faced the barrel, met the flame, a hero's act without a claim. Anne Marie Murphy, amidst the strife, shielded a child and paid with her life. Eva and Irma in Uvalde's hall wrapped children close, absorbed it all. Aaron Feiss, a coach so tall, placed his frame to block the wall. Michael Lansbury raised his voice. To buy kids time, he made the choice. Their names should echo year by year, their courage honored, voices clear. Yet headlines fade, their memories still, while fabricated heroes climb the hill. For some are crowned with scripted fame, their valor built on words and blame. Charlie Kirk, with pointed sneer, was hailed a hero, loud and clear. But he shed no blood for the sake of others. He risked no life to save a brother. A senseless shooting to shed a tear, another lost with the 18,000 a year. The truest heroes deserving acclaim are not those motivated by fame. They act selflessly to protect innocent souls, sacrificing life in actions so bold. So speak their names, let silence fall, for they are the true heroes, one and all.